Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders, past and present, and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 98.9fm.com.au, or on the podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company this morning. Now, in 2013, the High Court of Australia handed down a very significant decision in relation to the case of Aboriginal man William Bugmy. And it found that the Aboriginality and social disadvantage of an Aboriginal defendant must be given, as quoted, full weight in the determination of the appropriate sentence. But in reality, I guess what's actually happening, a new study currently in draft form by the University of Technology Sydney finds that the lack of information around an Aboriginal person's specific community background, usually in the form of these pre-sentencing reports, renders this principle shallow. So in a time when Aboriginal incarceration is rising and tearing apart communities, I think it's important to have a look at the reasons more closely. And who better to get on the program than criminologist at UTS and the leading author of the report, Thalia Anthony, who also has a long history in working in Aboriginal criminology. And obviously, I also hope to talk to her about other issues that have been playing on my mind. And she joins me on the phone from Sydney. How are you this morning, Thalia?
G'day, Amy. I'm really well. And it's such an honour to be talking to your audience today. And I'd also like to recognise the continuing sovereignty of First Nations people in Australia.
Thanks so much for that. I just wanted to ask, how did you sort of get into this line of work, and why did you become interested in criminology?
I think probably unlike a lot of people, I grew up in a family where Aboriginal lives really did matter. And I say that it's probably unlike a lot of white people because there's just not that much attention in the media. So if, you know, you want to try and see whose lives do matter, the media focuses all on the lives of white people and you know, middle-class white people or white police officers or people in authority. But fortunately, I was able to grow up in a family that, you know, did appreciate the injustices towards, you know, Aboriginal people. Also, I come from, my background is Cypriot, so it's an occupied country too.
Oh, right.
And I just have grown up knowing that, you know, there's a real problem there when, you know, you have, for example, people protesting on the streets against the death in custody being locked up straight away, and yet those responsible for deaths in custody being able to go above the law and have no accountability. And I've seen that, you know, since I was growing up. This isn't a new issue. Yeah. You know, and I was at the protests in 1988 in Sydney, and it was so clear that there's a real divide, and the over-policing was very apparent from a young age.
I was just going to say, I mean, when you were studying to become a lawyer, that must have been the time when there was that groundswell of movement around Aboriginal deaths in custody that ultimately led to the Royal Commission?
Yeah, definitely in the 1990s. And I think to some extent there was a bit of a sense of hope that the Royal Commission would reveal these issues to the public that, you know, Aboriginal people have long known and experienced, and it would lead to change, a real accountability within the system and a real commitment to reducing Aboriginal people in custody in prisons, which is the fundamental problem. There are too many in prisons, there are too many in police custody, and that in itself is a real violation of human rights.
Yeah.
The fact they, you know, then are overrepresented in deaths in custody just adds, you know, a complete insult to that that injustice that kind of underlies overrepresentation in custody. So I think, like, there was hope that this would turn around, but in fact it's been the opposite. There've been more Aboriginal people being fed into prisons and more deaths in custody, and the accountability pretty much remains negligible when it comes to those responsible for those deaths.
I was just wondering, when you said the fact, you know, the core problems are around the numbers of Aboriginal people that Australia does lock up. I mean, when in the leading up to the Royal Commission, obviously a lot of the protests were around fear that there had been, I guess, you know, things happening behind closed doors which were leading to these deaths that prison officers and police officers were directly accountable. But I guess what the commission found was those fundamental lack of duty of care, which to me is just as violent, I guess. Is that part of the reason why, I guess, that sort of groundswell of protest has, not in Aboriginal communities, but in the wider Australian context, has sort of, you know, gone down, I guess, over the past 20 or so years?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, probably a bit more insidious. There's just that cruel indifference to Aboriginal lives. So there's, you know, maybe not always the brutality, the very blatant brutality. Sometimes there is, and we saw that clearly, you know, in Queensland with Murrunji Dumuji, that it can be very violent. But it's more just that indifference that means that they're not treated with the same respect. They're not treated as a human being as other people would be treated. And this is in prisons. This is, as we've seen with the Miss Do case in Western Australia, also in the health system. And so it kind of gets, you know, brushed aside because, you know, these people are seen, police or health staff, as upstanding citizens, and they're doing the best they can in the circumstances. But really, the fact that they are in these positions means that they should be held to account, because if we can't be trusting these people, who can we trust to protect us and to look after our well-being?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And when you consider a lot of those cases, I remember when you mentioned Miss Dew particularly, one of the arguments that I think the Premier Colin Barnett came out with was the fact that rates of Aboriginal deaths in custody were actually lower than white deaths in custody. And I was always really interested in that statistic. It was, just to me, I just figure if there are white deaths in custody, they're ultimately probably for different reasons than Aboriginal people who are dying in custody. Is that sort of founded in research, or is it just something I'm sort of, you know, thinking just from anecdotally, I guess? Is there any research around that?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, we don't get that much information about prisoner deaths. In fact, we don't get much information about prisoner circumstances, full stop. And I think, you know, the prison population generally are not given circumstances that would promote good health and longevity. So there are, I guess, a proportion of deaths that are in fact just due to so-called natural causes, and you would suspect that a greater number of the deaths would be non-Indigenous people, because there are more non-Indigenous people in prison. But when we actually talk about rates and rates per 100,000 people in the population, for Aboriginal people, the deaths in custody are outstandingly higher. So if we just looked at pure numbers, yeah, maybe we would say there's more white people, but when we actually look at it as a proportion of the Aboriginal population, Aboriginal families are much more likely to experience the death of one of their loved ones in custody.
Yeah, that's a really important point to make, because I think a lot of the shock jocks bring that statistic out, and I guess very few people know how to counteract that. So I think that was a really important thing to clear up.
Absolutely. Given, you know, the size, and, you know, numbers are always a controversial thing, but of the Aboriginal population, it is so clear how disadvantaged they are in the criminal justice system, and how much greater their criminalisation is at every point, at, you know, policing, at the types of things they're policed for. Like, you look at Miss Dew in Western Australia, she was, you know, basically fined for things relating to offensive language, which for a lot of non-Aboriginal people, they wouldn't necessarily be subjected to that. And then it just escalates, you know, you end up in custody, you're not cared for, so your chances of, you know, falling ill or passing in those circumstances are really escalated for Aboriginal people.
I was reading a piece, and I guess it's just one of those other continual facts that are raised in the media around, you know, particularly by certain commentators, talking about the fact that there's this perception that Aboriginal people are being locked up for minor crimes, and that they're not being locked up for violent crimes. And then there's all these facts around the fact, apparently, the majority of Aboriginal prisoners going to prison are for violent crimes. Is that true from your research
No, I mean, look, there are a significant portion who are in prison for violent crimes. The nature of those crimes, generally not seriously violent crimes, but certainly violent crimes, and I think that's something that is a concern and that needs to be addressed. But the majority of people are in prison, of Aboriginal people are in prison for things like property crimes, crimes relating to traffic offending, crimes relating to public order, especially, I would say, in police custody, very much overrepresented for public order offences, even where they haven't committed a crime. There's a whole range of laws, like in the Northern Territory, paperless arrests mean you don't have to commit a crime as long as you're seen as disorderly by the police. They can lock you up to 8 hours. And protective, so-called protective custody, where if you're perceived as being intoxicated, you can be locked up in police custody. So those types of things target Aboriginal people. Also, I think one thing we overlook is that there's a lot of Aboriginal people in custody because they're denied bail.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
If you're, you know, before you're even convicted or sentenced, if you're seen as a risk, then you won't be let out into the community until your trial, which could take a number of years.
Yeah, so you could be locked up for not doing anything really even.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's like, you know, almost 30% of Aboriginal people in prison are there even before trial. And I think we really need to look at, you know, why are courts seeing Aboriginal people as at greater risk? And what are the problems with those perceptions, you know, and what are the racial assumptions and the implicit bias in making those types of judgments?
And that sort of bleeds into the report you actually have, you know, you've drafted, which is around this pre-sentencing, the problem of these pre-sentencing reports. Can you explain to our listeners what are pre-sentencing reports?
Yeah, so everyone pretty much who faces a prison sentence will have a pre-sentence report prepared for them by a corrective services officer. And this usually involves an interview with that officer for half an hour, 45 minutes, maybe an hour. And they then go away and look at what sentencing options might be appropriate. So anything from kind of, you know, community work orders to prison, really. So there's a whole range. And the idea of these pre-sentence reports is for the courts to make these decisions with information that is relevant to the individual. Now, what you said at the beginning of the program about the High Court's decision, the High Court has said, well, someone's background is relevant, including Aboriginal background. And yet these pre-sentence reports are not coming to terms with the significance of someone's Aboriginal background.
Right.
They may mention that the person is Aboriginal, they may not. They certainly don't mention what community they come from, what nation they belong to, you know, which family they grew up with, what the circumstances were, whether they had access to education, health services, all these things that are relevant to an individual's chances in life and to what sentences might be appropriate. For example, you know, going back into the community and giving something back to community might be really important for both that person and the community. Those types of things aren't considered because what the focus of these reports are really is on the criminal risk factors rather than looking at this person holistically, including looking at this person as a member of a community that is different to, you know, a white person's experience and chances in life.
So going back to, because I guess the grounding of this was the Fernando principles, wasn't it, in 1992? Can you explain a little bit about why it was important in that decision and what the Bugmy decision sort of entrenched as well, sort of supported in relation to those Fernando principles?
Yeah, so in Fernando, the Supreme Court in New South Wales held that an Aboriginal person needs to be, considered in sentencing in terms of potential disadvantage they experienced as a child, you know, impoverishment or lack of employment opportunities, as well as the exposure they may have had to any abuse or alcoholism. So somewhat, like I would say, problematic in its assumptions, but also looking at, and I think this was a really important point, the problem of alienation that Aboriginal people experience in prisons. So I think, like, there were really positive things about the Fernando judgment, but I also think it was a bit limited in kind of the white system's conception of Aboriginal people. And Bugmy was a bit the same in that regard. It focused very much on childhood deprivation as a feature of an Aboriginal person's background without really, I think, considering contemporary issues, particularly at the moment, the very harsh impact that a person's removal by state authorities of their own children, that impact that it has on their well-being and the trauma that creates. So by only focusing on someone's disadvantage as a child rather than, say, their disadvantage as a parent and being subject to that state intervention or the removal of their children means that we're not getting a full experience, a full picture of the experience of Aboriginal people in prison. And so on that level, I guess that's what prompted the report that we just did, is that these principles are good, but they are still principles coming from within the white system, and there needs to be information, expertise that the Indigenous community has in relation to its members that can provide a better picture of what is needed for these individuals' well-being and for them to actually have a, you know, prospect of moving on from whatever brought them into contact with the criminal justice system.
And you talked to quite a few magistrates and judges and different, I guess, legal people when you did this report. I guess what was their more common view? Did they sort of understand or recognise those limitations that they had?
Yeah, they were kind of crying out for better information about Aboriginal community background. They said most information, you know, comes from white people, and that was really limited. Like, they wanted to know things like what was the family background of the person, what was the relationship, say, between the community and police? Did that affect the person's, I guess, response to the police if they were confronted by the police and, you know, then kind of led into a situation where they were convicted for offensive language or behaviour? All these things are really important in explaining, you know, the nature of the offence and what kind of remedy is needed. And the judges we spoke to, the judicial officers, as well as the lawyers, were all saying that access to that kind of information is not available within the criminal justice system.
Right.
So we need to look at other avenues and do it in a way that I think is not only punitive, like do it in a way that we actually recognise that the criminal justice system can be part of the problem and there needs to be avenues outside of that system.
I guess the whole system is geared towards that, those punitive punishments more than rehabilitation. It seems just from talking to you, I mean, there just doesn't seem to be that willingness or that drive to focus on criminal justice as more about rehabilitation.
And I think going back to your question about the Royal Commission in the early 1990s, what we've seen since that commission is a real, and this is across the world, particularly in the West, a real focus on law and order. It's all about locking people up, about perceiving them as a risk to community safety, rather than as seeing individuals as requiring some level of compassion and empathy, and as capable of moving on from whatever brought them into contact with the criminal justice system. And I think we see that in terms of our policies around criminal justice, and I also think we see that in terms of our responses to victims within the criminal justice system, so victims in relation to deaths in custody, but also, I guess, many Aboriginal victims who, you know, have experienced violence from non-Aboriginal people.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering also, is this a specifically a New South Wales problem, or have other states sort of figured it out, or is it solely sort of focused around New South Wales?
Do you mean in terms of the
pre-sentencing reports? Yeah.
Yeah, look, up in Queensland, they're doing some interesting work with community justice groups to try and, I guess, have them more involved in providing information to courts through pre-sentence information. So that's really just commenced in the last couple of months, and be interesting to see how that initiative goes up there. But, you know, in New South Wales, we've kind of been slow to look at this issue, and I think it's just a sense of complacency that, you know, the judiciary are capable of making good decisions. They're smart people. They know the law. And I think that complacency is really problematic because it doesn't tackle implicit bias. You can't see implicit bias. Although, having said that, a few weeks ago on the ABC, there was a big report about a magistrate coming out and actually being vocally racist against Aboriginal people in public. So it can also be explicit, but generally it's implicit. And it's because judicial officers don't know what they don't know about Aboriginal people. They assume they have it covered. And what our report wanted to expose was that you can't know these issues unless you talk to Aboriginal communities. You can't assume that you understand their life experience, their worldview, but also you can't even understand, you know, all the positive things. They take a very they're willing to see deprivation, but they don't have their eyes open to the many strengths in Indigenous communities that could play an important role in the lives of people being sentenced.
Yeah, and that is very hard to prove, a magistrate looking the other way and not sort of seeing that strength. I think there's that perception that Aboriginal strength has to be in white terms rather than in solely Aboriginal terms, isn't it? And how are they supposed to decolonise their own thinking in that sense?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at bail decisions, one of the big factors that, you know, determines whether someone gets bail and therefore released before their trial is, you know, whether they're employed or whether they have stable accommodation.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, for Aboriginal people who have family, you know, say if they live in a city, they have family in a more regional or remote place, they might need to travel a lot. And for the courts, that's a bail risk. You know, that's seen as a negative thing that means they should be put in prison so they don't move. Whereas for an Aboriginal person, it's seen as actually a really positive thing because it means they keep connected with family and with community, and that actually prevents them from getting into trouble because it grounds them and also connected with country. So it's seen as, you know, something very simple is seen in a completely different light from a, you know, Aboriginal person's perspective compared to a non-Aboriginal judicial officer's perspective.
And it's interesting because I'm just picking out a little bit in the report where you've actually explained this really well, talking to former judges who, one has observed that magistrates, especially in country towns, can hold beliefs that Aboriginal people are hopeless just from they see. I guess they see it so often, you know, a lot of Aboriginal people coming through their courts. It's almost like, do they become a bit jaded and they just expect more of the same? They're not willing to change their thinking?
Yeah, I think they... I mean, that I think unless they make an effort to actually, you know, work within the Aboriginal community, that is the only exposure they have to Aboriginal people. And they think they know Aboriginal people because they know the people being sentenced in courts. But that's, you know, a small proportion of Aboriginal people. And you know, obviously too many are caught up in that system. But it's not, you know, always the responsibility of the individual. The blame shouldn't always be pointed at that individual. The judicial officers need to more critically think about, why is this person coming back? You know, is it because they're hopeless, which is often the perception, or is it because they're being targeted?
Mm.
Is it because the police have, you know, them on file and, you know, there's profiling going on, and therefore they're more likely to, you know, come within that, you know, net of policing. And I think, you know, especially when you look at crimes relating to public disorder or even some property crimes, it's much more likely because of that type of profiling. And, you know, after I wrote the report, I had a an Aboriginal woman from Armidale in New South Wales call me and say, I'm so glad you wrote this report about some of these attitudes, because we feel that, you know, our boys are being picked up by the police for staying out at night and being on the streets and being disorderly, whereas the white boys, if the police see them, they'll just pick them up and take them home.
Yep.
But our boys get taken to the police station. So I think, you know, judges need to unpack the reasons why people are coming before their courts and not just, you know, fall back on this idea that it's the Aboriginal person's problem, but actually look at the problem within the system.
Another issue that's sort of raised throughout the report is that magistrates and judges have very shallow views of the role that trauma plays as well. I mean, how does that come into play, I guess, in those reports?
But yeah, there's, like, from what we've heard, there's no level of depth to the understanding of trauma in the pre-sentence reports. And, you know, admittedly, these people aren't trained to write about that. But even, I'd say, many white professional people in mental health aren't trained to really understand trauma and intergenerational trauma that has persisted since colonisation, the stealing of people's lands and children and, you know, displacement of modes of governance. Like, that is really profound and distinct for Aboriginal people. And I think unless you have experience or have the opportunity to spend a lot of time in Aboriginal communities, you don't really understand what that means and how that needs to be addressed, what healing involves. And if you don't really understand, you know, that process, then there's no way you can provide, you know, some route for these individuals to overcome that trauma that puts them in a better place for their overall well-being and a better place to contribute to their community and feel safe and feel respected. And I think, you know, sadly, what the criminal justice system does is not only fail to address that trauma, but it contributes to that trauma. And I think, you know, I feel sometimes really sad about the what the system's doing, not just the criminal justice system, but also system responsible for child removal, or so-called child protection, what that's doing to the next generation, who are feeling like, you know, really, you know, discriminated against, but also just feeling as though they're being removed from their culture and going through a whole new process of segregation and separation.
And that fear, that overpowering fear of having your children removed as well, that was sort of brought up in relation to what particularly women tell community corrections. So there's that lack of trust and that fear that children could be taken away if they give away too much information that actually hurts these pre-sentencing reports.
Absolutely. I think one thing that should be pointed out is that of in terms of the prison population, the fastest growing group is Aboriginal women. And these women, it's not only kind of really sad that many are being put in prison, but also what happens when they come out of prison. That, you know, I heard one case this week of a woman who comes out of prison after a very minor offence, very short time in prison, because most people in prison are there for very short periods of time for very minor offences. And, you know, the first thing she finds out is that her child has been taken. And I just think that, you know, that's punishment for life.
Definitely. Yeah. And why would she need to go to prison? You know, you think about that child having their mother taken away for a minor crime and how that child is going to be as well, you know. I just don't see the punishment doesn't fit the crime, I guess.
Yeah. And to some extent, for me and for so many people, that would be worse than going to prison.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather not that I'd want to face this choice, but I'd rather go to prison than have my child taken from me indefinitely. And I think that, you know, the intersection between those two things, criminal justice system and child protection system really needs to be looked at and held to account. And we do see kind of with pre-sentencing a lack of understanding of the effects that child removal has had on a mother or on a child who has been removed.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the most important things that would assist women who have had their children removed and have as a result gone into, you know, addiction or mixed with the wrong people or whatever has manifested due to that trauma, the only real solution is for them to get their children back and to be with their family and to, you know, nurture those relationships. But the problem is that because we don't understand this, you know, because the criminal justice system isn't able to comprehend this, the solution tends to be just seen as a punitive approach rather than what's in the best interest of the individual, the family and the community. And I think if there were more attempts to look at these things broadly, it might result in better outcomes for individuals, but just generally better outcomes for the community.
Yeah, it's such a complex problem, and I hope to get to talk to you more in detail about the child protection issue fully, but I just wanted to, you know, when you're talking about the people who are writing these pre-sentence reports, are the majority of them white? I mean, do a lot of Aboriginal people have a say in these sort of reports?
Look, I don't know about numbers, but I could very confidently say the great majority are non-Indigenous white people. And I think to some extent, let that be. You know, that's the system. It's set up for its purposes. And I don't think we should try and get more Aboriginal people writing those types of reports. I think there needs to be a completely different service,
right.
A service that's kind of run by an Aboriginal organisation like in Canada, you know, or an Aboriginal unit within a court service rather than a corrective services or justice department, so an independent unit that has control of the whole process. Rather than just putting Aboriginal people into, you know, the job that's already being done by corrective services, I think create something quite different that's controlled by Aboriginal people and is actually broader than just providing information to court. Certainly there needs to be better information to court. There needs to be better sentencing outcomes, less punitive sentencing outcomes. But there also needs to be a service that is there to provide support to these people after sentencing, you know, to link them up with people in community. I know in Canada, for example, one of the things they do is if the individual doesn't know their parents, they will try and find out who the family is of that Aboriginal person. So there's a lot of things that need to be done, and if that, you know, kind of flow on or through care could occur for those individuals by an Aboriginal, you know, organisation that has the capacity and the knowledge to help, then I think it would be much more valuable than just the employment of Aboriginal staff.
Yeah, it's just like they're put in a template and expected to work towards that predetermined template, really. They can't really change the narrative of it, I guess.
That's right, and they need to change the narrative. We were told that it's a very set narrative that does need to change, and at the end there's a very kind of numeric formula in terms of the level of risk that person presents to the community, and that's really, really kind of atrocious for someone to be given a number in relation to their risk and not seen as a human being. So that it needs to change, but I don't think, you know, Aboriginal people need to do that work. That's for the system to change. You know, they need to go back to providing reports that better, you know, identify this person's background. That's for all people who go into prison. But I think separate to that, there needs to be specialised community reports that can comment on things that are only within the expertise of Aboriginal people and that can also go on to support them after the criminal justice process.
And I think when you're looking at this, underlying this is exactly what you're talking about at the start, this perception. And I think what you're talking about this bias around the fact that Aboriginal lives don't matter. I mean, I think that's fundamentally the underlying factor, isn't it? This perception that Aboriginal people, particularly women as well, don't matter. Do you think that we can find a way to confront that underlying perception?
Well, I think being able to, you know, draw a picture of Aboriginal people as people and not as risk factors or, you know, part of a criminogenic profile is a really important start. We just have a, I guess, discourse in criminal justice that is very much steeped in, you know, negative stereotypes. And we need to challenge that. And I think providing that human story is so essential to, you know, changing that mindset. But, you know, I think it's a big task. And I think all the kind of protests going on at the moment, the Black Lives Matter protests, is really important to getting people to rethink this, because it needs to be a huge cultural shift. And I feel a bit, I mean, I guess just at the moment, in light of the election and a lot of racism that is kind of, it seems like, being legitimised, that there's a bit of a swing in that direction, but heartened at the same time, you know, in Sydney at least, going to the Black Lives Matter rally on the weekend, seeing that, you know, there's momentum building around this. And hopefully, you know, there were a lot of not only Aboriginal people but African people, Muslim people at that rally, hopefully, you know, building solidarity to kind of, you know, show that what is happening to Aboriginal people is, you know, part of a broader problem in society and in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, most definitely. We have a very our own problems over here in relation to Black Lives Matter and how it specifically affects Aboriginal people particularly, and I think it's important to note that. And one of the recent really horrific stories, obviously, that you were actually interviewed for Four Corners about was that really horrific case of Lynette Daly, and just the fact that two white men can go about for so long without being charged over the murder of an Aboriginal woman. I mean, I believe that it would happen, but it's still astounding, I guess, to just see the place of Aboriginal women in Australian society, and this could go on so long. I mean, when you heard about that case, what was your original perception, I guess?
Just before that, Amy, the first thing that really startled me was that I hadn't heard of it until I was approached by Four Corners about an interview. And so I got the autopsy, and I was shocked that, you know, the media hadn't covered this, you know, for so many years, until someone, you know, at the ABC decided that it was important, but it had been really overlooked. And then I went through it, and it was like heartbreaking how she died. She basically had a sexual assault inflicted on her, leading to tears that resulted in her bleeding to death. Now, how can, you know, anyone, and these were intoxicated men, how could anyone think that that could not be a criminal offence in so many respects? Sexual assault, grievous bodily harm, homicide. I mean, there's so many potential charges. And yet, 5 years after it occurs, still nothing had happened. And the coroner had said these people should be prosecuted, and still nothing happened. So I was kind of just so sad for the family that they had to go through losing her daughter, losing their daughter, and then, you know, children losing their mother, and nothing happens, even though the coroner's finding that there should be prosecutions. And so it required that media, but also, you know, petitions and lots of anger in the community before there's an independent review that has now found that there will be prosecutions, so there will be charges laid, and of course there should be, looking at the evidence and the coronial findings. But why does it take 5 years when it's an Aboriginal woman? You know, why is the criminal justice system so reluctant to step in to protect these victims. It just beggars belief.
Yeah, I find it very hard to believe. And I was just, you know, when you talk about the petitions and the public outrage, there shouldn't have to be any public outrage. I mean, the DPP should be really on top of this. And I find it, I was quite, I saw one, I think the former DPP actually talking about this wasn't a race issue on NITV. And to me, I can't see it as any other way but a race issue, because I just do not think that any other place, a white woman, two black men, for example, if the situation had been reversed, there'd be no way that we'd be talking about it 5 years later.
Yeah, 100%. Like, the, you know, the irony is that as soon as an Aboriginal man commits an offence, you know, they're locked up straight away. As soon as an Aboriginal woman is a victim, you know, her life is almost ignored by the DPP. And it, yeah, like you said, the evidence was clear. It, you know, all the circumstances pointed to meeting the elements of a number of crimes for which they're now charged, and for which, you know, coroners and independent barristers unanimously found that there was no question. So you can only fill in the gaps, you know, that there wasn't a prosecution on grounds that were not, you know, legally based, on grounds that were something else. And I think racism really kind of is kind of the obvious ground.
What do you think of the fact that, I guess, the legal fraternity is very quick to say that it's not racism? Is that part of the problem, that they're not owning up to this really, as you were talking about, the unconscious bias that is obviously so evident to us, but I guess, yeah, to them maybe something they're quite resistant to?
Yeah, and I think it's not for them to say. I think it's a huge problem that they say it's not racism, but really it's for Aboriginal people to say whether it's racism or not. Yeah. They're the ones experiencing it. And, you know, like, every person who works in this system should critically be thinking about how Aboriginal people are perceived within that system in a, you know, way that is, you know, very self-aware. And by saying they're, you know, not being racist is part of the problem, that they're not analysing their decisions, they're not analysing the processes in the criminal justice system. So if we can't even get to that point where we recognise that there is racism, we really put up a roadblock to going any further to addressing the issues. And again, to look at Canada, when they began to start, you know, introducing Aboriginal pre-sentence reports was when the government and the court said, well, actually, the criminal justice system is racist. Wow. We actually over-incarcerate Aboriginal people, and we're part of the problem, and we need to do something. And that's when change occurs. When there's denial, we continue to entrench the bias that has long existed.
So these pre-sentence reports, finding a way to, as you said, take the Canadian example maybe and start looking into setting up independent sort of Aboriginal organisations to do this, this could be actually the first step or one critical step to trying to address this incarceration crisis, do you think?
I think it's definitely one important step, because ultimately it's the sentencing courts that determine that the person, you know, goes to prison. But like I said before, we have a very much law and order inclined climate where, you know, there are problems at a number of levels, at the level of, you know, the legislation, you know, the fact that we have these offensive language laws, the fact of, you know, the policing, the over-policing of Aboriginal people in relation to those types of crimes, the denial of bail. So there's so many levels, but I think if we can start to identify racism in aspects of the criminal justice system, we open up a whole debate about the operation of that system, and we call into question, you know, the assumptions upon which it is based. And I think it's really important to recognise that, you know, since early colonial times, There's been separate punishment for Aboriginal people in legislation, and even now, when you look at the Northern Territory intervention legislation, the Stronger Futures Act, there's separate legislation that means that police have special powers in Aboriginal communities.
Mm.
So there are kind of separate systems, separate punitive systems that have always existed for Aboriginal people, and we need to recognise this. Obviously I've focused on the sentencing stage, but we need to recognise that this occurs throughout the system and it has, you know, very deep roots, and start to undo some of those biases through that recognition, but also I think through empowering organisations to do work around Indigenous wellbeing that is non-punitive. I think we can't just, you know, say the system needs to get less punitive. We actually need to match that with making communities stronger and more able to, you know, I guess to some extent, deal with Aboriginal justice issues on their own terms as well.
Definitely more self-determination. That's the only way
Absolutely.
That things are going to change, is it? Because it scares me when you talked about Lynette Daly and just seeing what she had to go through, and the fact that we hadn't heard it for 5 years. It's easy to think it's just one case that's gone through the cracks, and you'd hope it is just one case, but obviously if this has happened, it's most likely to have happened before, and it's most likely to happen again, which
and
is what scares me.
If there's no justice, it's definitely going to happen again. If, you know, if those men or if police officers who, you know, are responsible for deaths in custody, if they can get away with it, there's no, you know, message sent that it's unacceptable. In fact, the message is, and, you know, we saw with Chris Hurley in Queensland, the message is that the police and the media will get behind you.
Yeah, definitely.
And that is such a dangerous thing, because in his case, before the death of Murungi Dumuji and after the death of Murungi Dumuji, he has committed crimes against Aboriginal people. So we can see that the system is actually buttressing those patterns of injustice.
Yeah, and I mean, Chris Hurley is constantly in and back and in enforcing court over, over charges of affecting white people, and suddenly he's stood down from the QPS and everything like that. So it's amazing that you can be responsible for an Aboriginal man's murder but get off on it, and then, you know,
a white victim.
Yeah, you really see the difference in the way black and white victims are viewed then, don't we?
Yeah, how black lives are valued or not.
I wanted just to change the subject just in the short time we have left, in relation to what you're talking about with child protection, because I know that you were recently involved with the Grandmothers Against Removal Forum down in New South Wales. I just wanted to ask you your impressions of that current movement, and I guess what you see it, where you see it going.
Is there much awareness of it up in Queensland?
We actually have our Queensland branch, yeah. But
yeah,
I was interested because obviously facts and docs are quite different, even though they have similar sort of tactics, obviously. It's always interesting to see what's happening in New South Wales.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's been so we set up the Redfern group really only kind of 7 or so months ago, and it's been amazing to see the growth of that movement and the growth of that group. Again, Aboriginal child removal has been happening, you know, for as long as colonisation. But I think it became really apparent to the grandmothers that, you know, sitting around talking about it, writing reports, having these apologies in Parliament means nothing.
Mm.
And it's only through mobilising, supporting one another, you know, sitting in the office of facts when there is unlawful child removal, that there's going to be action. You know, we can make as many kind of formal complaints, which also obviously, you know, is part of the work of grandmothers to support people and to, you know, keep the department accountable. But it's only when there's proper mobilisation and unity that we're seeing change. And in New South Wales, a couple of months ago, this led to a meeting with the minister, who's now committed to review all cases of Aboriginal child removals within the last year.
Wow, that's huge.
It's a huge achievement for the grandmothers. And I mean, having said that, at the meeting, he committed to a review for the past 2 years, and he's since kind of, you know, stepped back on that, and now saying in the past year, he's also not ensuring that the review is independent, so it seems the review will occur within the department. So we're having another rally on the 4th of August to starting at the Family Court in Sydney to demand that this review is properly independent, because the problem, if it's not, is that facts are just relying on the same stories and the same perceptions of Aboriginal families that they always have.
Yeah, what's the point then of a review?
Exactly, and that's the problem, you know, that mentality within facts, and there needs to be some oversight that needs to come from, obviously, outside of facts if there's going to be an improvement. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, we can have reviews and we can have principles and, you know, as much policy as we like, but unless there's a serious decline in the removal of Aboriginal children, then grandmothers are not going to sit still. They'll keep going, and they'll keep going till really there's Aboriginal control of, you know, Aboriginal family issues.
I think there should be. I just think, you know, it's just gone too far. And when you're talking about the incarceration crisis, I mean, they bleed straight into that system, you know, all those children who were taken away.
Yeah, we've known that since, you know, since 1997 with Bringing Them Home report, that there's a direct connection between kids taken from their Aboriginal family and ending up in, you know, juvenile justice and then the adult prisons. So we know that, and yet the government continues to try to break down Aboriginal families. Aboriginal families are strong, so they're not going to easily break down, but they do whatever they can to displace these children. And I think, you know, like until I really became involved in the work of grandmothers, I had no idea about the level of intervention, and I think it has a really, just that intervention even before the removal, it has a really detrimental effect on the confidence of mothers and grandmothers and families, and that can only, you know, worsen the situation when it comes to, you know, strengthening communities and getting people out of the criminal justice system.
Thank you so much for that, Talia. And we probably could have talked for another hour just about child removals, but it was really, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.